Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big piece of the science of attraction boils down to scent. While we write love poems and croon about romance, the scent of fertility, it turns out, is driving an awful lot of our lives. Step by step, new research in evolutionary psychology has been uncovering what and why, from how we choose mates to what we wear. This hour on Point, the new science of attraction. You can join the conversation. What's really in control here, the mind or the pheromones? How much of our behavior still goes back to our inner ape? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Wow, okay, let's dive in here. Joining me from Tallahassee, Florida first is John Maynor, professor of psychology at Florida State University. He studies how evolution and hormones affect sexual attraction and relationships. John Maynor, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Also with us from Culver City, California, is UCLA professor of communications and psychology, Marty Hazelton. She studies female behavior and the effect of hormones. Marty Hazelton, thank you very much to you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. I know this evolutionary psychology in this neck of the woods, the last decade, there's been this sort of constant drumbeat of things coming out, and I'm looking down some of these headlines here, just a few of them in recent years. Women's voices become more high-pitched during ovulation. I'm going to ask you about all these. Here's another. Women put more effort into their clothing and grooming during their most fertile periods. Women avoid contact with their fathers during ovulation. Here's one that says women may have evolved to cheat on their mates during the most fertile part of their cycle. Now we've got the latest one coming out, and we'll talk about that. But Marty Hazelton, first to you. You're the woman here. We want to be sure we've got this right. What's the arc of insight or you know, new understanding that we're on here?
Well, the findings basically boil down to showing that ovulation is an important factor in changing women's social behavior, and it may also have effects on how others respond to women. So there could actually be outward indicators of fertility, of ovulation, that people pick up on, and it, for good evolutionary reasons, should change their behavior.
Didn't we think for a long time that ovulation in humans was kind of a non-factor, mm-hmm. invisible, not like, I don't know, rhesus monkeys or animals where it's just right. evident right on the
right.
the animal's body?
That's right. So, for example, chimpanzees have really dramatic sexual swellings. Humans don't have this. Some would say, thankfully, but we do. You know, and these are quite dramatic outward indicators of fertility in non-human species. And when you compare those species to humans, the natural conclusion is that humans don't have cues of ovulation, things outward indicators mm-hmm. of fertility. But we are now finding that that is not the case. They may be somewhat more subtle, although we're actually, one of the surprising things to me here is, just how many different cues there are. So you mentioned some of them, voices, the way women are behaving socially, the way they're dressing themselves, but also their magnitude. Some of these effects are actually quite large. But they don't compare with the chimpanzee case, but if you think about the drivers of human behavior, relative to other things that drive human behavior, these are actually non-trivial effects. They okay. are, they're actually, you know, so for example, body odor attractiveness. We've done some work in which we collect underarm samples from women on high fertility and low fertility days in the
okay.
cycle.
Mm-hmm. On a swab or something.
Gauze pads okay. that yep. women are kind enough yep. to wear taped under their arms.
Okay, very kind indeed.
And Yes. And we collect those at a high fertility and a low fertility day of the cycle. High fertility window for a woman who has a 28-day cycle would be about 14 days into her cycle and a few days before that. That's 14 days in is about the point at which she ovulates, and a few days before that, those are also fertile days where if a woman had sex with a man, she could become pregnant.
Right.
So we compare that window of time to a sample that is collected after ovulation, but well before menstrual onset.
What do you do with these swabs from the different times?
Well, we collect them all and we keep them in the freezer so that we can preserve them in a similar state. And then we have some kind male volunteers who come in and smell them. And they will smell the samples presented in two plastic squeeze bottles, arbitrarily labeled A and B.
Okay.
And they'll tell us which of those two they prefer more, which of them they find sexier, and which of them they think would be from a more attractive woman. Yes, both samples come from the same woman, but they tend to choose the high fertility body odor sample about 60% of the time, as opposed to 40% of the time for the low fertility body odor sample. And that's a fairly dramatic difference. By psychological standards.
And they have no idea. John Maynard in Tallahassee, you've got the latest research coming out on this curve where you're dealing with exactly this scent, I guess. Tell us about your latest experiment and what you found, if you would, John.
We've done a variety of research sort of similar to what Marty was talking about, where we've looked at how men respond to the scent of women who are either at the fertile phase or the non-fertile points in their cycle. And we've found a variety of really interesting physiological, psychological, and behavioral changes in men responding to the scent of ovulation. So, for example, in one study similar to the methods that Marty described, we had women wear T-shirts for three nights in a row, either at the fertile phase of their cycle or a non-fertile phase. We brought the T-shirts in, and we had men smell them. The women were already gone. They didn't know who had worn the T-shirts or even that women had worn the T-shirts. Then we had them spit in a vial. And with their saliva, we were actually able to determine their testosterone levels, their current testosterone levels. And we found that men who had
smelled— Drumroll, please. what's the outcome?
Men who had smelled the scent of ovulating women displayed higher current testosterone levels than men who had smelled the scent of non-ovulating women.
And the significance of that, of higher testosterone levels, what's it indicator for?
Yeah, testosterone is a very powerful hormone that in both sexes, but especially in men, determines their essentially their current sex drive, their desire for dominance, their desire to take risks, all sorts of things that women tend to find attractive.
Wow.
The idea is that men at some level are detecting when a woman is fertile and are responding, at least at a hormonal level, in ways designed to mate with that woman and to increase their attractiveness with that woman.
And give us the latest experiment. This is interesting. This was with a woman brought into proximity regularly with men, and the different response of single men and men in relationships. Tell us
That's
about
right.
it, John.
That's right. We recently ran an experiment in which we had a trained research assistant posing as another participant.
Okay.
So she was really working for us, but other people, the men in the study, thought she was simply another student at Florida State University. During the course of the study, they interacted quite closely. They sat next to one another at a table, putting together a puzzle made of Lego blocks. The men thought that this was essentially what the study was about, teamwork, putting together a puzzle. But the real study started afterwards. What we had men do at the end of the study was rate the woman on how attractive they thought the woman was. Unbeknownst to them, we had actually tracked where in the menstrual cycle this woman was all, you know, throughout every session of the study. Some of the men were interacting with her during her very high fertility phase. Some of the men weren't. And the interesting thing that we found was that men's judgments of how attractive this woman was affected by essentially whether or not she was ovulating. Single men, when the woman was ovulating, judged her to be much more attractive. This makes sense in light of
All the T-shirt sniffing and everything else. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. The twist was that occurred with men who were already in a committed romantic relationship. They actually judged the woman as significantly less attractive when she was ovulating. The idea is that they were at some level especially attracted to her, which threatened their sense of commitment to their relationship and thus motivated them to ward off any temptation that they might have felt by saying, oh, yeah, you know, she's not really that attractive.
Well, let me ask you about that because you caught my attention right there. You're saying you've got evolutionary psychology at work here, the single man smelling that scent of ovulation and finding her more attractive. Men in relationships, not. How do you know that it's this sort of, I don't know, superego intellectual thing overriding the attraction to the scent of ovulation rather than some even deeper evolutionary biological response in the mated up guy? How do you know that, John?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I don't think it's any sort of superego. I do think that this the responses of both single men and committed men follow an evolutionary logic. For a single man, it makes sense to respond to a highly fertile woman with greater attraction and a desire to mate. For men who are already in a relationship, it makes good reproductive sense, especially for some men, to essentially maintain their current satisfaction and commitment to their relationship. Humans, unlike many other species, really benefit from having both parents around, and so there are great reproductive benefits for to be reaped by couples that stay together over the long term. And so what we think is that humans possess very deep-seated, biologically based mechanisms designed to help them stay in long-term committed relationships and to maintain fidelity to those relationships.
Okay, we've got to start on this. We're going to dive much further in the infamous lap dance study out of the University of New Mexico. Lap dancers got bigger tips when they were ovulating. Men didn't know. There are the tips. We'll ask why and how much of our sort of relationship creation and maintenance is in our hands and how much is in the scent of fertility, the scent of a woman. We'll look at that. Men as well. John Maynor in Tallahassee, Florida, the Florida State. Please stand by there. And Marty Hazelton at UCLA. It's great to have you both with us. Listeners, you can join us. Are we just gussied up apes after all, driven by scent and ovulation? Are we blind to all this, driven by scent cues and biological status, thinking that we're driving ourselves, our lives? Women, do you even know when you're ovulating? Do you feel yourself presenting differently to the world, to men? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the science of sexual attraction, human evolutionary psychology, and the scent of fertility. John Maynor is with us from Florida State University. Marty Hazelton from UCLA. They've both done a lot of research. Evolutionary psychology and what's going on with our scent, our perception of scent, our interactions around reproductive cycles. We may be less free agents or have less agency in this arena than we thought. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you recognize the patterns that Professors Maynor and Hazelton are describing here? Women, do you even know when you're ovulating? Men, are you just slaves to the scent of a woman? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Marty Hazelton, we've got lots of reaction online here. And before we even mentioned it, we had a couple here. Y. Sterling writes, if fertility enters into the male brain when encountering a stripper, it must be subconscious. Yes. Kate here saying, yeah, I doubt customers ask about the status of her fertility. But in New Mexico, University of New Mexico, they looked at this. And what did they find exactly?
Yeah, they did a very bold study. So they followed lap dancers, a pretty small study, but the results were quite dramatic. They asked lap dancers to record their tips each day over over an entire menstrual cycle. And for women who were not using the contraceptive pill, those are women who normally ovulate, they have normal fluctuations across the ovulation cycle in their hormones, they earned about $100 more per shift on during that high fertility window than at other cycle phases. For women who are on the pill, their tip earnings were basically flat across the cycle. So this, we don't know what drove men to give women more tips on those days. It could have been something about the way the woman was behaving. Maybe she was more enthusiastic on those days. Maybe she was more interested in some of her patrons on those days. It could have been body odor shifts, lap dance. You know, male patrons in lap dance clubs are actually getting access to a lot of information. That would be one way we could think about it. it could have been something about a woman's voice. We've actually done research that shows that women's voices become higher in pitch when they're most fertile within the cycle. Pitch, how high a woman's vocal pitch is associated with how feminine and attractive her voice is. Or it could have been something perhaps even about her appearance. So we don't know what particular change there was. We just know that something was having an impact on men's behavior, and it was enough to get them to part with precious financial resources.
Yeah, I mean, people will endlessly kind of parse this because we're endlessly fascinated by relationships. Because part of what you're driving at here, Marty, is that we're not as unlike primates as we might think. We're more driven in similar ways. I mean, is that one of the bottom lines coming out of this area of research?
I think so, yeah. I think that because a lot of this is occurring, most of it, perhaps all of it, is occurring outside of conscious awareness. It's hard to come up with purely social explanations for these kinds of shifts across our hormone cycles. And so I think it provides basic validation of the notion that in order to understand human behavior, we're going to have to include a biological component to that explanation. And it also shows more fundamentally that that humans are mammals. And so a lot of the things that we observe in non-human species, we're also going to see in humans. You know, it might be the human version of it, and so it could be a little bit more subtle, or it could be manifested in something that only humans do. So the clothing, the shifts in the kinds of clothing that women wear in different points in their cycle, that's
also
something.
And you're saying they may dress more, I don't know, showily or flamboyantly or something.
Well, so it depends. It depends on the study. There have now been three or four studies that have looked at this. And in our initial study, we had UCLA undergraduates come into the lab, and we just photographed them in the clothing that they wore to campus that day. Mm-hmm. And what we found was on high fertility days of the cycle, their clothing was more attractive. And this was as rated by independent judges. It was they were dressing up a little bit more. In another study, spearheaded by Christina Durante at the University of Minnesota, she actually put women in a competitive context. She said, imagine that you're going out to a club or a party and there will be lots of attractive members of the opposite sex there. Draw an outfit that you would wear out. And then she provided female forms and colored pencils. And women were actually quite creative in drawing these outfits.
Okay.
They drew one outfit on a high fertility day of the cycle and then another outfit on a low fertility day of the cycle. And what she found was that women who drew those outfits on high fertility days of the cycle, they tended to show more skin. So she overlaid a square millimeter grid over the figures,
okay.
And she saw that women were wearing more, were picking more skimpy clothing, but they were also dressing up more. But you have to put women in that kind of a context. So women, when they're going to clubs and parties, might dress sexier when they're fertile, whereas if they're just going about their daily lives, going to campus, going to work, perhaps it manifests itself just in dressing up.
John Maynard, how much of this is new? I mean, you've got a lot of research and the findings from it. At some level, it's dazzling, and we can't take our eyes away. At another, I mean, isn't this sort of time immemorial? I mean, the idea that we have a biological component, I guess we know that. You know, a kiss is still a kiss and all that. I mean, isn't this kind of baked in our understanding of ourselves in another way?
Well, the idea that humans are very much like other mammals and other primates in a variety of ways, that's been around since about the mid-70s. For a long time, you know, everybody knew, all scientists knew that humans were like other species in terms of their biology. But for the longest time, folks, including other scientists, thought we were really divorced from the rest of the animal kingdom in terms of our behavior and our psychology. We had, you mentioned free will earlier, that somehow because we are such complex social species that we're no longer guided by our hormones and by physiological changes. We know that's not true. There are certainly important differences between humans and other species. We have culture. We are much more complex. We have self-consciousness. But nevertheless, there are many, many important and fundamental commonalities between humans and other species. A variety of different lines of research coming out of evolutionary psychology since the 70s has been providing a lot of validation for this. The research we're talking about today, the menstrual cycle effects and the effects of ovulation on men's and women's behaviors, that's a relatively new area within evolutionary psychology, and I think it's one of the most fascinating areas, and I think we're going to be seeing that area gaining a lot of steam over the next decade or so, in part because so many of the findings are counterintuitive. They really kind of fly in the face of the idea that we are unlike other mammals. In fact, we are very much like other mammals.
Let's turn to our listeners. They, like us, are out there living this. Lori in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for calling, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and professors. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I find myself chuckling listening to this. I work in a mainly male-driven field, probably about 99%. And despite what I think and what I feel, you know, particularly less attractive during the ovulation cycle and in the lead up to the menstrual cycle, I find that the men are responding in exactly to the opposite. I see the same gentlemen day in and day out, and certain days, certain
Watch
days
out.
Of the month, they are responding to me and with a little bit more attention than maybe I would like sometimes.
Lori, do you, I mean, asking around, it seems some women kind of know when they're ovulating pretty well, and others just kind of oblivious to it. Are you very conscious of where you are, and you see it patterning up here?
Yes, I am quite conscious, quite physically active, and, you know, have been able to tell. And, of course, you know, I'm up on, you know, emotional changes within myself that cue me in, you know, sometimes. And also, like I said, you know, sometimes the general feeling of feeling unattractive, you know, that will even cue me in sometimes that, you know, that things are coming and it's going to be the week of, well, anyhow.
The guy's buzzing around. Yes, Marty, please.
Can I make a comment on this?
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to distinguish the premenstrual period,
mm-hmm.
which is the time that occurs right before menstrual onset.
Right.
And people have long believed, including many women, that there is something that happens at that point, that women experience different moods, that they might feel that their bodies are somewhat less attractive and so forth.
But this is different from the ovulating part of the cycle.
Yes, that
right?
is different. Mm-hmm. So that is much later in the mm-hmm. cycle mm-hmm. than the fertile period. And the fertile period is difficult for people to identify because everything about actual ovulation is hidden within our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Menstrual onset actually does manifest in
right,
a way.
Right.
Yeah, it does manifest in a way that people are able to observe. Women
mm-hmm.
are able to observe that in their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And the few days before menstrual onset, there are also often some telltale signs, physical symptoms that women get. So it's important to distinguish between the premenstrual period, which has different phenomena associated with it, and the ovulatory period, which in some ways we could think about that, you know, what this research shows. Premenstrual period, we knew about that before. What this new research shows is that we have a new time of the month and with it comes a wide variety of changes. And some of them are actually more positive. Women feel more positive about
mm-hmm.
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They may feel sexier. They may be more interested in certain kinds of men and so forth. So it's quite different.
Lots to pay attention to. Lori, thank you for your call. We've got a tweet here from Twitter. You know, somebody's seeing this hour, this conversation coming, a woman, and saying, I'm already cringing. Is this cringe-making to you as a woman, Marty? You know, does this objectify women in some way? Or is there liberation in understanding?
I think that the more knowledge we have of our bodies, the more educated choices that we can make. And so if hormones are causing us to feel differently about ourselves and our relationships, then I think that that's a useful thing to know. It could have a substantial impact on our decision making. One thing that's important to keep in mind here is that these changes were built over millennia by evolution. And what is the outcome that evolution produces? It produces traits that improve the chances of reproduction. In the modern world, we as individuals are trying to maximize could be something quite different. It might be personal happiness. So in some of our work, we've seen that women, when they're most fertile within the cycle, when they're nearing ovulation, they become more attracted to men other than their romantic partners under some circumstances. I think that if women understand that the force behind that is an evolutionary force and that it doesn't necessarily produce the same, it wouldn't necessarily foster the same endpoints that what a woman is interested in, preserving her happiness, would foster. Then
but then you're drawing a distinction between the woman and her biological impulse there. I mean, this goes back to the research you did with the University of New Mexico back in 06, saying women may have evolved to cheat on their mates during the most fertile part of their cycle, but that's still the woman, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's a woman, but we have multiple motivational systems in our minds. And we make choices every day. And so we can, you know, do you eat a piece of chocolate cake or not? Well, chocolate cake looks really delicious, but I'm, you know, trying to be healthy, right? So, and the same thing is true for mating decisions. So our desires might propel us in one direction, but at the same time, we say, well, but, you know, I really value my relationship with my partner.
Right.
And if I understand why my desires are pushing me in that way, I might say, okay, well, that doesn't mean that I don't love my husband.
Right.
That's his ancient biological force that is having an influence on my behavior. And perhaps that allows people to compartmentalize and say, well, you know, I'm not going to let that steer me around.
Right. There's some know thyself dynamic to this. And yet to it's hard to differentiate here what's going on. Johanna is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Johanna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is Johanna. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm mostly calling with a question for the researchers about whether they've studied oral contraception and how the interruption in the fertility cycle and the fact that a lot of women may not be ovulating may affect us and then also for society going forward.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I wanted to ask about that. Thank you, Johanna. I mean, we've got a listener, Ed, asking about this as well, saying, you know, if the pill changes people, changes women as they you know, if we communicate through our hormones and the pill messes with those, are we messing with our communication about choosing mates? Marty?
Yeah, it's possible. There's been a lot of speculation about this, but there haven't been studies that have been done to test this in a very direct way. But what we see in ovulation cycle studies is that when women who are on the pill are also included in the study, they don't show the patterns of change across the hormonal cycle, which makes sense because the pill blunts hormone shifts. It basically flattens out women's hormones and makes them about the same on different days of the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting question whether this could. So one thing that we've seen in earlier work is that women tend to prefer different traits when they're more fertile within the cycle, when they're examining male partners.
Like what?
It's the human male equivalent of the peacock's tail. So sexy traits, more masculine faces, more muscular bodies, even more dominant male behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And women prefer those more when they're within the fertile window than when they're not. And so it's possible that there could be some downstream consequences of that in terms of mate choice. Might a woman who doesn't experience those changes on average be less likely to choose a more masculine partner than a woman who does experience those changes with fertility? But we don't know yet. So far, it's very indirect, the evidence that suggests that the pill could have these effects. But I do think that it's it certainly is an interesting question. The lap dancer study, we saw that overall women who were using the pill earned fewer tips. I would love to know if after the publication of that study, it changed the choices that women were making about the contraceptives that they were using. It's important to bear in mind here, of course, that the pill actually does something very important, which is prevent pregnancy. I have my undergraduate students will sometimes come up to me and say, "Professor, does this mean that I should go off of the pill?" And I say, "Well, just remember what the pill is doing for you." And the pill has had all kinds of very positive effects on women's achievement in the world over many decades. So I think we have to be careful about interpreting this pill versus non-pill difference that we see too strongly before we have direct evidence that looks for example. So a piece of direct evidence that we need would compare women before they go on the contraceptive pill and after they go on the contraceptive pill and see how that changes their behavior. And we just don't have that yet. Right now what we have is we have women who are not using the pill in one group, and there are all kinds of reasons why women choose not to use the pill, and women who are using the pill in another group. Those women could be systematically different from each other in a lot of different ways.
Wow. Hormones, scent, cycle, driving so much here, you start to wonder how much of what we're up to is in our control and how much is not. Marty Hazelton, please stand by. And John Maynor, this is really fascinating stuff. John Maynor of Florida State University with us, and Marty Hazelton of UCLA. We're talking about the science of sexual attraction, evolutionary psychology. Listeners, you can join us. Do you recognize the patterns that Maynor and Hazelton are describing here? What do we do with these insights? Do we go with our inner ape, struggle along with on the high road? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the science of sexual attraction, how evolutionary psychology comes into play in our relationships, in our lives, even the scent of fertility. Everybody knows that scent of a woman. Here it is, 1992, the movie. Young prep school student takes a job as an assistant to a curmudgeonly retired Army officer. Here's that scene, a little bit of it, where the officer, played by Al Pacino, gives his assistant a little advice on women.
Women. What could you say? Who made them? God must have been a genius. Hair. They say the hair is everything, you know. Have you ever buried your nose in a mountain of curls? Just wanted to go to sleep forever. Or lips. And when they touched yours were like that first swallow of wine after you just crossed the desert.
Scent of a Woman, 1992, and we knew a lot more since then. But maybe we've known a lot all along somehow. John Maynor is with us from Florida State University, professor of psychology there. Marty Hazelton is here from UCLA, professor of psychology there as well, communication too. And you can join us. What do you think? Do you recognize the patterns being described here? Is this enlightening? Did you already know it somehow? John, Marty, we've got a lot of feedback online here. Y says, I think biology rules male behavior right up to the age of reason. For me, that was about age 40. Kate says, I miss ovulating when on the pill. When you follow the natural rhythms, you definitely notice that others do too. Here's Corey says, in marriage and relationships, our animal instincts do not always serve us well. My relationship with my wife was born from raw physical attraction. Getting to know her deeply came later. There's something backward about this. On an intellectual level, we aren't always physically attracted to the one who will be our ideal soul mate. Let me go to Alan in Hartford, Connecticut, calling in. Hi, Alan. You're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well.
Well, I would agree and disagree. Clearly, as I've been a gynecologist for 25 years, and I can tell you clinically that the evolutionary link is just unmistakable. But even more so than my patients is what I've learned over the years about their husbands. I mean, you just have to pick up any newspaper or listen to the news and see the stupid things we guys do because of our testosterone.
We're pretty loaded too when it comes to the chemical. But do you see the change? Do you see the change in interaction between sexes, in women and men at the ovulation time?
I do, absolutely. And they're easily discernible. I mean, you know, women tend to relay the same type of symptomatology over and over again. What we call the menstrual millimina, you know, and the signs that when ovulation is occurring, that it's almost like pheromones in the animal kingdom. But the only thing I did want to mention, I would take exception to the researchers from Florida State. I think I would disagree with their conclusion about the men who were in the committed relationships who were not interested in the women who were ovulating.
Right, or overrode the interest if it was there, I guess, yeah.
Right. I think their reasoning is wrong. I think that if they drill down and find out if these men were already parents, they might find that it was the fear factor, because I am a father of four teenage daughters.
Yes.
And if I knew that my wife were ovulating, I'd head for the hills.
What, because you've got enough children already, you mean?
Because, yeah, the fear factor of having another child. I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek.
Alan, we've got it. I'll take that to John Maynard. I appreciate it. Let me get one more call here first, if I may. Ross in Lexington, Massachusetts. Ross, you're on the air. Hi, Ross. Ross, are you there?
Caller. I had a similar question, because I know that you ask about that study as well, Tom. And I wanted to find out further if your researchers there had specifically asked questions of the men as to why those men in committed relationships were not interested in those women that were ovulating. Because it would be interesting to find out, is it a fear factor? Or was it our need to be together? And then a related question to all this is, if you could talk to it, is were there any specific ties of certain characteristics of men to certain women's ovulations that would sort of matchmake on the ovulation cycle?
Well, for example, like what? I'm not sure I know what you mean there, Ross. Like what? What are you thinking?
Well, let's say that, if certain men would smell the ovulations of different women, where there's certain attraction types of one to another.
Okay. Thank you, Ross. John, first to you on this, pulling apart a little more the men, the made-it-up men in relationships who didn't go after the ovulating woman or didn't describe the same degree of attractiveness there. And Ross is looking for more sort of understanding of how you discerned the reasons for that.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's difficult to get at those reasons simply by asking the men, because a lot of this is flying under the radar of consciousness. We don't think men know why they are attracted or not attracted to a particular woman based on her ovulation, because, to be honest, I think most of the men in our study don't even know what ovulation is. All the participants in our study were university students. Very few of them had children, so I don't think that would be the explanation.
Okay.
What some people have suggested is that maybe it's not that the men who are in committed relationships were really not attracted to the woman. Maybe they were just saying they weren't attractive to try to look virtuous or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nor do I think that's the explanation, because if men said they weren't attracted to a woman just to look good, we would expect that to be really constant across the woman's menstrual cycle. When she's ovulating or not ovulating, that shouldn't really make a difference. If men are just saying, oh, yeah, I'm not attracted to other women as a way of, you know, looking like they're committed, ovulation shouldn't really matter.
But here's what I don't get, John. Marty's saying that when women are ovulating, they're more likely to cheat. You're mm-hmm. saying, which might make sense evolutionarily, I don't know. You're saying when men in relationships perceive the ovulation, they kind of put a brake on it. Now, why wouldn't evolution also push those men to want to reproduce when they smell ovulation in or outside the relationship?
I think a lot of it comes down to what Marty alluded to earlier, is that humans are fit with a number of different motivational systems. We certainly have motives that drive us towards short-term sexual partnerships, and this is one of the things that we know tends to occur at ovulation, both among women and among men. What's relatively new about this work is it also brings in the long-term mating motives. We know that aside from short-term sex, many people can and are highly motivated to maintain long-term committed romantic relationships. It has great reproductive benefits along with affiliative benefits. And so you can sort of think of this, I think, as a balance or a trade-off between short-term mating and long-term mating. And there are a variety of factors that I think will determine which one wins out. Relationship satisfaction, personality, local social norms, all of these things I think can push things in one direction or the other. But either way, I think both the short-term mating side of things and the long-term mating side of things can be understood through the lens of evolutionary thinking.
Marty, a layman could look at these two studies and say, you know, here the men represented the ovulating woman and they even told themselves that she wasn't so attractive. Whereas you've got this study with New Mexico saying ovulating women were more likely to step out on a mate. Do men have the high ground here despite all reputations?
Yeah. I think it would be useful to see whether John's findings, which I assume, John, that those were with undergraduate men. And perhaps those were relatively young relationships. It would be useful to see how generalizable those findings are to other samples, because we know that men and women have affairs. This happens.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we've heard.
Men sometimes have affairs with women when they're fertile, and they produce children as a result. So this does happen. I think that that we need to do more work, including more empirical work, to find out when, as John says, the short-term versus the long-term motivation wins out. I actually think that there's a good evolutionary logic to men sometimes engaging in opportunistic sex with a fertile woman. He can increase, and so think about this over evolutionary time, and think about the Darwinian benefits. He would have been more likely to produce another child.
Sure.
And so the men who did that over evolutionary time were better represented in subsequent generations. So that and as
so
a result of
that. So what's
up
with these guys in Florida in this experiment?
I don't know. It's a good question. They're quite faithful in Florida, I suppose. Perhaps John wants to address this.
I don't know, John, if there's any way to pull the covers back any further there or not.
Well, I mean, the evidence that we've provided really just pertains to how attractive these men judge the woman to be. Now, whether that would translate over time into maintaining commitment and avoiding potential infidelity, that remains to be seen. So Marty's exactly right that many, many men and women do cheat on their long-term partners, and that does at times carry reproductive benefits. So
in evolutionary terms, though, maybe not in paternity terms.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, there's quite a bit of evidence from evolutionary psychology and social psychology that has looked at when and why people will do things to maintain and protect their relationship when they feel threatened by other attractive people out there in the world. Sometimes these strategies work. Sometimes they don't work. Sometimes people end up cheating. Sometimes they stay committed to their long-term relationship. The idea is that both of these routes can provide useful strategies. So cheating on a long-term partner, with a very attractive mate, as Marty has shown that ovulating women might do, well, this might carry important genetic benefits to one's offspring. At the same time, staying in a long-term partnership, especially if there are kids, and investing a lot in those kids, it provides a different kind of a strategy that can also increase a person's reproductive success.
Many vectors here. Abby in Nashville, Tennessee. Abby, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to say I think this is very interesting, but I'm studying behavior analysis, so automatically my question goes to how are you measuring this attraction in the men, especially like single men versus married men? How are you making that connection that they might be attracted, but they're making the decision to, you know, not let themselves be attracted?
How do you measure? Good. John, what do you say?
Well, in the study we've been talking about, we simply asked men to rate our research assistant on how attractive and desirable she was. But that said, across a variety of studies, we've used a number of different measures. From aside from subjective ratings of attractiveness, we've also used we've measured behaviors that we know reflect the degree to which a man is attracted to a woman. So, for example, we know that when a man is attracted to a woman, he'll often behave in kind of risky and showy ways. He'll actually mimic the woman's nonverbal behavior. And we've looked at these too. So, for example, we've done research where we look at the extent to which a man will mimic the behavior of a woman when she's ovulating or not ovulating, whether he'll take financial risks. And we've found that men will, in fact, behave in riskier ways, like, you know, hitting on a hand of blackjack as opposed to sticking when he's around an ovulating woman.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, he'll actually mimic the woman's nonverbal behavior, her posture, more when mm-hmm. she's ovulating than when she's not. So there are a variety of ways of measuring this.
Mark in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Marty, John, and Tom. So I'm a psychotherapist. I work with a lot of folks looking for help both with sex and or gender. And so I was wondering if for your male participants, whether or not you're collecting any information on either what they say their sexual orientation is or what their actual sexual practices are. And so my curiosity is whether, if these are men who are also having sex with men or men who identify as gay, whether or not they are still having the same types of behavioral changes around ovulating women.
Marty, what have you seen over the arc of your research here when it comes to sexuality?
Yeah. I wish that I had an answer to that question. What I can say is that we tend to have heterosexual subjects in our studies. Now, we don't ask them about that's just their stated sexual orientation. So it's possible that they also engage in some same-sex behavior. But my assumption is that primarily the people who are in our studies are preferring and actually having sex with other sex partners. It's a fascinating question, what happens when you put two women together or two men together. So you put two women together, do they respond to ovulation cues? Fascinating question. We don't know the answer yet. You put two men together and you introduce an ovulating woman, do they behave differently toward each other? It would be absolutely fascinating to know.
Let me get one more here. Chris in Baltimore. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, our time is short, Chris. Give it to us.
Yes, sir. My question is, women tend to assess men for their, you know, ability to provide. And I was wondering if this is strictly a visual cues that they take, or are there some pheromonal indicators that are more subtle? Is there like a thinking pheromone versus a physical labor pheromone that would be a stronger attraction one over the other for women?
John, how about it? Is there a scent to testosterone, or what about bank account? Does that have a scent?
There is a great question. Both matter. So we know that women are attracted to men who have the ability to provide resources and wealth. We also know that women are attracted to signs of testosterone, and there is evidence that men with high testosterone do smell a little bit different than men with lower testosterone, and B, that women can detect this and tend to prefer men with high testosterone. And going to one of the former questions, there's actually evidence that homosexual men also prefer the scent of other men with high testosterone.
Well, Marty, does all this mean that those little ads in the back of men's magazines, you know, for these little bottles of, I don't know, hormone scent have been right for all these generations? You sprinkle that on and the gals will chase you around town or vice versa?
Well, I'm skeptical, I must say. Well, you know, we actually don't know what the chemical component is of women's body odors that is changing. Now, if we could bottle that, then that might actually be a perfume that, or at least a component of perfume that women might want to wear. I'm skeptical about the male pheromone formulations, just because none of them seem to have completely taken off. If they were really that effective, then I think that everybody would be using them.
Well, everybody keeps looking and wondering, and I'm sure listening very closely today, thinking about their own personal experience, interactions, and these amazing patterns from the mists of time. This has really been fun and interesting. Marty Hazelton at UCLA, thank you so much for joining us today. Great to have you with us.
It was fun. Thank you.
And John Maynor at Florida State University. Thank you, John, for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Mm-hmm. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.